Let's figure out what mattered this weekend together. Hi, I'm Bill Radke with KOW's Week in Review. I'm glad you've tuned in. Along with me, Zeki Hamid, Program Director at Humanities Washington, Claudia Balducci, King County Council Member, Ijeoma Oluo, local writer, editor-at-large for The Establishment. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Great to have you here. This week, Seattle media ganged up. KUOW, Seattle Times, King 5, Crosscut, Real Change, Seattle Globalist, and other media focused in on the issue of homelessness. So in a moment, we're going to ask whether housing is a right or a privilege. But first, let's start with something more metal. We're going to talk about what we learned this week, beginning with Paul Allen. This week, the Microsoft co-founder donated $1 million to set up 13 new housing units in Columbia City. These are inexpensive, steel-framed, small, about 200 square feet, stackable, modular rooms. Here's the man who builds them.
These are absolutely code-compliant, everything about it. They're insulated, sound-insulated, temperature-insulated. You will not be able to tell the difference from a conventional apartment in Seattle. They'll be steel frame. They will be modular, as you said, stackable, but they will not be any different from a conventional apartment.
And if you're thinking cold metal box or rain drumming loudly on a roof, it's not that.
Not that. The roof will be insulated, soundproofed. You're not living in a tin can.
That's Dale Sperling, founder of the Seattle company One Build. And he says we could put more of these rooms. We could put them in church sites, parking lots. They come with communal kitchen and laundry and bed furniture storage. And this is important. Social services, medical care on site, mental health services, case management professionals. Better than a tent. A lot cheaper than a Seattle apartment. Thank you, Paul Allen. Ijeoma, though, you want more from our billionaires, right?
Well, I mean, I would really love it if Vulcan wasn't so busy snatching up all the property around the city and raising the prices that are creating new homeless people each and every day. I would much rather see his efforts go towards that. I mean, this is a drop in the bucket for him. And when you consider, like, how much damage his company has actually done to rents in the city, I mean, it just feels like this little, you know, nugget that he's handing back to kind of deflect from that.
Claudia Balducci, how do you feel about that?
You know, I think that people want to be here in the Northwest. People want to live here. They bring their companies here because, and then there are good jobs here, and it creates a cycle of demand. It's there's two sides to it. It makes it a good place to live. People want to be here. I want to be here with my family. I moved here from another place because I could have a good life here. But it also, the demand creates high prices, and high prices definitely feeds into the homelessness crisis that we see here today. So I think that it is very positive to see the private sector stepping into the space that's normally for government and agencies, nonprofit agencies, to help with providing affordable housing. But I think there's a point that the private sector's role is more than just making a contribution to affordable housing, you know, with a capital A and a capital H. We should also be looking at market solutions that help to keep the prices of housing affordable, because there's enough supply for all of the demand, and currently we don't have that.
So you're saying build more, we need to build more housing. Does that include single-family neighborhoods becoming more multifamily, as a lot of them don't want to do?
Well, we need more housing units, generally speaking, and there's definitely room to build. There's room to build more single-family units, and there's room to build more multifamily units. There's zoning to do just that in places. So I come from the east side, and one of the things that we did when I was in Bellevue was we upzoned several of our industrial neighborhoods and created a whole lot of room for additional housing that didn't necessarily change the existing housing, but is going to create thousands of new units over time. The goal, though, that we have to look toward is that those are affordable to a wide range of people and not just the highest end.
Zeki, before we move to bigger issues, do you have any reaction to Paul Allen's stackable modular? He's contributing to these one build units, these rooms.
Yeah, it's a good start. It's a really good start. And the question for me is let me phrase it this way. It is in the best interest of Paul Allen and people like Jeff Bezos to have less homelessness and create a better environment. So this is a good start. I want to see a lot more, but I think this is the system that we live in. It's a capitalist system. And so just like Claudia, just like you said, I mean, the demand goes up. That's just the nature of the system that we live in. I'm really glad to see the partnership, the public-private partnership. It's innovative. I want to see more of it. I think we are primed for innovation here in the Northwest, and this is a pretty good start. Let's see where it goes from here.
Claudia, you mentioned you're from Bellevue. Most of the media focus has gone to homelessness in Seattle, of course. What's the situation on the east side?
So there definitely is homelessness. I went out on the one-night count earlier this year with people, and we walked along some of the hidden places on the east side where you don't see it quite as much, but there are many people living out, living in cars. It's a regional problem. We see it across King County. It's just very, very visible.
What kind of services are there for people?
So this is something that is an interesting aspect of this, and I think something that we could shine a light on with the coverage is that the services are not geographically evenly available, so that if you're a homeless person in Bellevue or Auburn, you might have to be sent someplace else to get services as opposed to being able to get them near where you live, where your support is, where your job is. A lot of homeless people work. They just don't make enough money to have a home.
So, why is there nothing for them in, let's say, Bellevue?
I think it's because the issue has developed. It's lagging, if you will. You've seen a lot more of it here, and it's more of a growing problem on the east side. But there is work going on right now. We've had a winter men's homeless shelter, but we don't have a full-time homeless shelter. So that's one of the projects that the city of Bellevue and the King County is working on right now together to try to build a full-time men's homeless shelter with services so that we can house people who are homeless on the east side instead of sending them someplace else.
Is there serious resistance to that?
As yet, it's been I was surprised. This was something that I brought up when I became the mayor in Bellevue, and I walked into a big meeting, and I sort of just laid on the table that we were going to work on building a homeless shelter, and I was stunned at how little resistance there was. It remains to be seen. We haven't had public meetings yet, but I think that so far there's been a lot of support.
Okay, so, Zeki, you said that all this coverage this week in the media and ongoing coverage had you thinking about whether or not housing is a right or is it a privilege? Why is that an important distinction?
Well, I'm a humanities guy, so I love these kind of philosophical questions to get there. But me and a friend of mine at work were discussing this. It said, is it a right? Is it a privilege? Because on one side, I can see the value of earning your housing, earning your living. But at the other point is that do we have that as a human right? So we looked it up, and it was actually in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 25, which briefly says...
Who put that out?
The UN.
UN.
Yeah, that was the UN. Eleanor Roosevelt had a huge role to play in that. And Article 25 just says, everyone has the right to a standard of living that is adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care. So... if the UN, under that declaration, says it is a human right, are we failing in the United States in providing that? Because if it is, then we're clearly failing. There's a lot of homeless people there, and our government is not providing the resources that go toward that. So I do believe it's a right, just like healthcare is a right. And in a place that has so much money, and not just the United States, but especially the Pacific Northwest. But at the other hand, I've never lived in a place that has such an aversion to taxes. And maybe that's part of the problem, that we don't have those funds to adequately provide housing for people.
Yeah, I'm not sure Eleanor Roosevelt convinced most Americans that housing is a right. What do you think, Jim?
You know, I think it's interesting when we have these conversations because a lot of times people talk about, well, you know, I worked hard for my house, I worked hard for my property, but we forget how generational that privilege is that allows people to own property. We forget that here in Seattle, for a very long time, people of color were not allowed to buy property in much of this city. We forget that in Oregon, people of color weren't allowed to, you know, buy property until, gosh, in the 70s. And we forget that women were not allowed to own their own property for a very long time. And these things are passed down generation to generation. You inherit property from your parents. You have something to get your own start and, you know, to buy another house with. We forget the high hurdles for down payments. We forget all of these things that really go hand in hand with generational privilege. And so, you know, if we talk about this and whether or not it's something that you earn, we really need to ask how much of this is actually being earned by the people who have it, and how much of this, you know, you just inherited when you were born.
Yeah, this is something I specifically talk to my kids about is what's earned, how little is earned. You know, you showed up naked and afraid, they say, you know, naked and cold. Except it's interesting because I also try to teach my kids that they're entitled to nothing, sort of that they don't have a right, that everything is a privilege. But maybe I would look at that differently if I weren't a single white upper middle class male. I mean, I don't think, you know, I think I'm self-aware when I'm telling them that everything's they're lucky for the, you're lucky if you get anything, kid.
You know, I own a house and I'm one of, you know, I'm one of few Black people I know in Seattle of my friend group who owns a house, and I am incredibly lucky to have it. And I tell my kids every day, like, if I die, this is the thing, this is the only thing you have, this is what you're going to get, and treasure this because it is such a privilege. And it's something I had to scrape so much harder for than other people will have to. And that bit of comfort, I mean, if you know that I have, knowing that if the worst comes to worst, I still have this piece of property that I can leverage. You don't know how important that is until you don't have it, or until you risk losing it, unless you grew up without it ever even being a possibility. I didn't even think I would ever own property. And now that I do, I realize fully how privileged I am.
Well, that's where informing yourself and having compassion come in, you know, whether you think something's a right or not. Guess what people are going through and figure out why that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the other part of it is when you talk about privilege. American citizenship to me is a privilege, and that's one of the things that we are privileged to have. Is it a right? Is it a privilege? For me, it's a privilege, but I'm an immigrant, so I had to really earn my citizenship. So once I came here, there is a certain level of hard work that you have to achieve, but at the beginning of it, I had to get that citizenship. So otherwise, I'd probably be stuck in a war zone right now.
You're from Jordan.
I am. Yeah. Jordan right now seems like it's safe, but it's heading in the wrong direction.
Before we move on, anybody feel like they have a final word about housing, rights, privileges, and maybe what we could do about it?
Well, I just want to say that as a politician, different from being a humanist, I'm a pragmatist. And whether it's a right or a privilege, it's a necessity. It's a necessity for human life to have shelter, owned, rented, provided. It's a necessity. And when people don't have it, they get very sick. And they do things that are damaging to the rest of society in order to preserve their own safety, in order to create a space for themselves. And so that's why, to me, it's our job to make sure that we, as a community, provide housing and shelter for people who need it, regardless of whether it's a human right or not. You know, to me, that label is, I guess it's important, but I think we need to do it just for the sake of being a healthy community that we all want to live in, and having our neighbors be healthy people as well.
You mean empathy and compassion and pragmatism are not mutually exclusive?
And
is that what you're telling
self-interest.
Me? And self-interest. Self-interest.
All together.
Are you talking East Side right now? Okay, that's Claudia Balducci, a King County Council member, former Bellevue Mayor, Zeki Hamid, Ijeoma Oluo, and we're going to continue to review and take away something from the week gone by. Stay with us. KUOW's Week in Review, live tweeting at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. This week we got a ruling on the police shooting of a Seattle man, Shay Taylor, African-American man. He came around a home in Wedgewood where police were surveilling someone else. Police say he had a gun in a holster, which was illegal because he was a felon. I've seen the video. They move in on him as he is getting out of a parked car, and they tell him to get down. And then we can't see what's happening because guess what? They weren't wearing body cameras. So police say he appeared to reach for a gun inside that car, and they tell him hands up. At least one of the officers shoots, and Taylor died in the hospital. The NAACP called it cold-blooded murder. This week, the Seattle Police Department's Force Review Board ruled that the officers followed the rules, that the shooting was reasonable. Taylor's brother is pushing for a change in state law, so I asked Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich how the law would change from what it is now.
The law has basically makes it virtually impossible to prosecute a police officer over the use of deadly force because of two words, malice and good faith. A prosecutor would have to show that a officer-involved fatal shooting resulted from malice, which is defined as evil intent, and a lack of good faith. And those are extremely high bars for a prosecutor to get over, and it has resulted in only one case of an officer being charged, and that officer was acquitted.
So the Washington legislature considered this change last session, didn't do it. Now a state task force is studying it. It might come up again next session. First of all, Zeki, when you saw the video, the shooting of Shea Taylor in Seattle, you thought about the unconscious biases that we all have. What do you mean by that?
So I believe there's an implicit bias that we all have. There's a great test that you can go online and take, an implicit bias test. If you just Google implicit bias and Harvard, it's through the Harvard, and many tests that you can take. So I decided to take a couple of them, for instance, and one of them was, it's a series of pictures and you have to respond to it really quickly by clicking on certain words. And after I took one comparing Barack Obama to JFK, and at the end it told me that I have a slight preference for JFK. And for the people who really know me well, they know this is crazy because my middle name is Barack, and that wasn't born with that. I changed my middle name to Barack because of Barack Obama.
You're a certified fan.
I am a fan.
At least your conscious self.
I am. Very much. The conscious self is a big fan. I subscribe to the fan club. I get the stickers and the T-shirts. But so that's what I mean by implicit bias. We all have these implicit biases, and that the problem is that the distrust that exists between the police department and communities of color is not something new, and it's not something that happens because we say what happens to Shea Taylor or Michael Brown or Freddie Gray. This is something that is deeply embedded in our history, in our legacy that spans generations. And unless we really take a hard look at who we are as a country and do some deep soul searching, we are never going to get to solve this problem. Right now, we keep putting Band-Aids on it, but we have to go back to and have this really hard conversation about who we are as a country and really address the origins of this kind of bias and discrimination structurally and individually.
I mean, I have enough trouble educating my conscious self. How do we get at our unconscious biases?
Well, these are really hard conversations to have, and we have to keep having them again and again and again. We had a conversation, a program at Humanities Washington called Think and Drink, where we host panel discussions in bars, and we did one on race and policing. And we had one of our, we had the assistant chief of police, and we had a professor from UW named Megan Francis. And at the end, Phyllis Fletcher was hosting this, and she asked, "What did you learn today?" And Megan said, "I learned that the problem is a lot bigger than I thought. And I already came in here thinking it was big." And she was talking about the distrust, not only the distrust, but the way that the police department and the communities, they're talking past each other. They're not having the same conversation. That's a big problem. There's, you know, I would encourage everybody to read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. It is one of the most brilliant books that I've ever read in my life, and it's a letter to his son. And in it, there's it's, you know, long book, but it's, there's one part of it that he says, he calls the people who, like the police officers who inflict this harm on people of color. He says that he calls them the destroyers. So the destroyers are merely men enforcing the whims of our country, correctly interpreting the heritage and legacy. And that's my point. We have that heritage. We have that legacy of discrimination and racism, and we have to get to the root of that problem before we start putting Band-Aids on what is happening right now.
Igioma, how much do you think all this has to do with the police? Are they just the flashpoint for our frustrations around this?
Yeah, I mean, I have always believed that the police are simply an armed wing of American consciousness. And so, you know, what we're seeing is the violent outcome of centuries of discrimination and oppression. You know, what's frustrating to me is, I mean, I was on this show talking about this decision by the legislature to not change these rules. And that was a very tough show. But I remember one of the panelists saying to me, "Well, we're lucky we're in Seattle. It's not like we really have people dying because of this." And I was sitting here as a person of color knowing that it was just a matter of time before someone dies because of this. Because it's a mix of things where we have this huge problem of this implicit bias, of so much subtle and insidious racism in our society. And then we have rules that enforce it and make it so that no one can be held accountable to it. And the truth is that we need to be holding ourselves accountable and we need to be holding our systems accountable. And it starts with those things that everyone hates. Like, it starts with calling out language. It starts with those little jokes that you think are harmless but actually reflect what you think somewhere inside of you. It starts with those little rules that are set up that center whiteness on everything, right? It starts with how we present people of color in media. It starts with all of this. It starts with who makes money off of what people people of color do? Who makes decisions for how people of color are portrayed in society? And then it also starts with how we structure our rules and if we are actually putting people of color in the room when we are making these decisions and understanding, you know, the needs of society and listening to people and saying, I believe you when this is happening. Because when I sat here and said this will happen, people did not believe me. And any person of color knew. You know, we know it's just a matter of time. We know that we all have targets on our backs because all we have to do is look a little funny, get a little agitated, or, you know, for heaven's sakes, you know, flex our rights as citizens with any of the police to be viewed as a threat. And that alone is legal reason for us to be shot because it, all you have to show is malice. So they can say, I was genuinely afraid without even questioning. Is that fear even reasonable? And we don't ask that. We don't ask, why are you so afraid when a black man makes a sudden movement and you're not when a white man does? And these are the sorts of questions we need to be asking ourselves and we need to be asking our society. And in the meantime, we need to be building safeguards so that even if you can't quite figure it out, you're going to pause and know that there will be consequences if you get it wrong.
Well, Claudia Balducci, you're on the King County Council. You work with the Sheriff's Department. In this specific case, and every case is specific, but, you know, legally, right, in this the video of the Shea Taylor shooting, is there, what's the alternative to trusting that the police said this, he was going for a gun, I feared for my life, I was acting without malice, I was acting in good faith. What's the alternative to accepting that?
You know, there's a struggle between the case specific and then sort of what we know
right. The
larger issues are around this particular flashpoint on violence, you know, with involving law enforcement. And in a case by case, the way our system is set up, it's very judicial, and you take each individual case and you look at the evidence in a vacuum, and you have to make a decision. And this is true whether you're prosecuting or whether you're – I've been a former jail director – or whether you're taking disciplinary action against a uniformed officer and firing them or something else. You have to look at the evidence, and you have to see, was the standard in place met? And so when you talk about, is the standard correct, that's a really important discussion to have. The standards have to be right, or else we won't be able to take – we won't be able to have corrective action that the community will see, that the community that will start to build trust, to start to build a more beneficial cycle. So in each individual case, you have to look at that. And one of the big challenges, so one of the things I've gotten to do in my life was I got to work on a Department of Justice oversight of our jail system. And as part of that, I sat in a small windowless office for several weeks next to a uniformed sergeant where we were working on law enforcement policies together. And in addition to just sort of learning a lot about that, we learned a lot about each other because we had to sit together in this little office for weeks on end. And I developed a much stronger appreciation and understanding for the challenges that he faced day to day in his job when he was out, you know, working with people. But he also learned to appreciate that there's a standard that a non-expert, non-uniformed community member brings into the room that is important for him and his colleagues to comport with. So that connection between the community and community standards being communicated to law enforcement and law enforcement needs and real interests in safety being communicated to the community is a place I think where this all starts. There's got to be a lot more interaction between law enforcement and the community in both directions, or else we're never going to start to bridge this trust gap that is absolutely fundamental to the problem right now.
You know, there's mentioned the story. I have a dear cousin of mine, and she's got two kids, and two and 4 year old, or he's five now, but and both of her kids are black. And last year, or it was around the time the Michael Brown shooting happened, they live in Maryland, and then she was in the kitchen, and the little boy comes in. He's 4 years old, mind you. He walks in with his hands up. He says, "Look, mommy, I have my hands up so that the police don't shoot me." That's what I'm talking about. This is real. This is visceral. And it's a direct threat to even four-year-olds. This is something that we as a nation have to grapple with. We have to do some deep, deep soul searching and implement some of the, you know, some programs to really figure out the root of this problem. But as I said, I mean, I sound like a broken record, but the root of the problem is generational. It spans centuries, and we can't just look at each individual incident and try to fix that. We have to fix the entire system.
Well, let's pick up on something that Ijeoma talked about. You didn't use the word ally, But and maybe Zek, you too talked to, yeah, you talked about, you know, calling out
right.
people. Okay, so last weekend's Pride Parade in Seattle had a record turnout. Hundreds of thousands of people, not just LGBT people, but as Stranger editor Dan Savage told us, Pride Month is also for straight allies. It's about being seen.
And we used to only be able to be seen and be safe in great numbers, and that was one of the missions of the Pride Parade, was let's gather so many of us together at one place at one time that the cops can't arrest us all and the bigots can't beat us all up. And now it's shifted, it's different, and it's about asserting the right to space that we've claimed, but it's also about still about being seen and about being seen by straight people.
I also talked, though, this week to a writer who's skeptical of the idea of straight white people being allies. His name is Michael Denzel Smith. He's a contributing writer at The Nation. And he says, you know, it's easy to call yourself an ally. You don't have to do much. Be a co-conspirator. Be an accomplice.
You have to have skin in the game. You have to be willing to stand up in the tough moments and to tell the truth and to be willing to lose the power and privileges that are bestowed upon you through those privileged identities.
What would that look like? How would I lose my privilege?
I mean, on an interpersonal level, you would lose friends immediately, right? Like if you, because no one's friends are perfect. And if you were to step up in exactly the right moments and make people uncomfortable by rebuking and refuting everything that they say that is offensive and oppressive, they would not like you anymore. They would not want to be around you. You're going to lose. You're going to lose your movie buddy. You're going to lose your basketball teammate. Right? Like you're going to lose these things. And are you willing to lose that sort of social capital? Are you willing to stand on what's right in the face of that?
Sounds familiar. Ichiyoma, we have been talking about allies a lot lately. What does being an ally look like to you, or do you think in those terms?
You know, it's funny because, I mean, I hear a lot of debate about whether ally is the right term. And honestly, I think whatever we call it, most people are doing it wrong. And it does come to challenging your comfort. And I've talked about this a lot. The truth is that if you want to correctly ally with oppressed people, your primary goal is to deconstruct the system that gives you your privilege so that we can rebuild one which pulls everyone up. And so you should be looking and challenging this system and say, wait, why do I get this and other people don't? And that's where it becomes hard because you're A, putting what you get at risk.
What would be an example of putting that at risk?
Well, you know, like I challenge my own privilege quite often. So, you know, I am a black woman, but I'm a light-skinned black woman, which means oftentimes I can say things very harshly, and it's viewed less threatening than a lot of darker-skinned black women would get. A lot of darker-skinned black women would just be called angry and bitter. And a lot of times I will hear people say, oh, you know what, when Ichiyoma says this, I get this a lot. They'll say, when you say it, I know you mean it. I know it's sincere. I know that you're out here looking out for the best. And I'm like, wait a minute, why when I say it? Because people have been saying this for generations. You need to challenge that because I look a little more like you. I seem a little less threatening.
I talked to Dani Aschini about this from the Gender Justice League. She says for various reasons that she's very acceptable, that she's the mayor of Transtown.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, people used to like, you know, I used to call it like the gateway black girl, right? When you can't handle full dark skin blackness.
Start with some Ichiyoma.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Just ease in.
Yeah. And the truth is that's, you know, that's a level of privilege that, you know, therefore, you know, values my proximity to whiteness instead of who I am as an individual. And I can benefit from that, or I can challenge it and say, no, this is wrong. You need to think about the flip side of this and what you are assuming about people who don't look like me. And that gets me a lot of, you know, a lot of side eye, a lot of people going, you know, why do you have to make this difficult, Ichiyoma? I was trying to do a good thing. I was trying to give you a compliment. We all need to challenge our privilege. And so when you realize that you look around the room and everyone looks like you, you need to start asking, why does everyone look like me? You know, when people act like it's a gift to bring like one person of color, when you find yourself being asked to represent all of the people of color, you need to ask, how come I get this? And you need to challenge it and not be grateful for your seat at the table. Instead, ask, how come there aren't more people at this table who deserve to be here?
Should I share what you said about half an hour ago when you sat down? You said, Finally, I'm not the only person of color on KOW's Weekend Review.
Exactly, right? And I've riffed a lot by tweeting this at you guys multiple times. And I will continuously challenge it. I know I'm in a privileged position to get here on the radio and be able to speak, right? But I don't want to be the only one up here speaking. Sometimes I'm like, come on. We need more. But that's what we need to do. And the more power you have, the more responsibility you have to continuously challenge that. It's not about putting yourself at the head of a movement. It's not about you being like, I'm going to be the savior of these people that I've aligned myself with. It's about saying, no, you know what? I'm going to break this down. And I may even give up my seat if I have to make sure that somebody who is underrepresented is here. And that's uncomfortable. You lose out. And it's not a win-win at first. At first, it really is. It's about, you know, evening those scales, and that means you have to give a little up.
Yeah. Okay, so there's Seattle gets this knock a lot. Seattle area white liberals get the knock, right, of having little at stake and saying the right things. Mm-hmm. There's also a risk, isn't there, of putting off allies who, yeah, they're not doing much, but they're doing something. Like, what are you saying? Like, don't come to that. Like, well, Dan Savage didn't say don't come to the Pride Parade. Are you saying, you know, there's always that question of, oh, it's not about you, Macklemore. Your white privilege song, it's not about you. There's a little bit of tension there with people who feel like, well, I'm trying to do something right.
Right, and that's the thing. We did actually another Think and Drink event. I'm promoting all the Humanities Washington programs.
Yeah.
But it was about, what does it mean to be black in a liberal city? And these issues came up. We had this young black man that stepped up to the mic and to ask a question, and he said, you know what? Just to be honest, I want my neighborhood back. You know, he used to live in the Central District, and he still does, and a lot of, you know, gentrification is happening, and he said, I just want it back. And some people were taken aback by that comment until somebody, Eric Davis, who was on the panel, said, no, I get this, brother. I know what he's saying. And he says, sometimes you just need to be comfortable where you are. And that's a tough thing to admit. I'm definitely a minority. I'm Arab. Not a whole lot of Arabs around. And sometimes I feel like I have to be a different person in public or at work or something like that. And I'm not really comfortable until I see my family. I was at a family reunion just 2 weeks ago. And on the way back, I just looked at my wife. I'm like, man, I was home. And home is not a place. It was just I was with my people. And not that I don't like other people. Of course I do. I love people. But at the same time, there's a level of comfort that comes with it. But just to go back really quickly to the ally thing, and I think language does matter, but I happen to like the word ally. And for me, what it means is you stand up for the rights of other people who might be needing something like you. So it is natural for Arabs and Muslims to stand with Black Lives Matter because we know what it's like. And we're going to stand up. We're going to go to the rallies. And most importantly, we're going to show up at the ballot box. That is one thing about allies. We have to show up at the ballot box. When marriage equality was on the ballot, allies showed up and they voted it through. So I think that's an important thing.
Well, I have put myself at risk by doubling the number of people of color on this panel. Claudia, I'm here for you.
Thank you. You're my ally.
Yeah, I see you. any thoughts on any of this, Claudia?
Well, when you play the clip about the Pride Parade and we read that article in The Guardian also about the San Francisco Pride Parade becoming so corporatized in some sense and it being too, I think the words they used were straight, white, and corporate.
Right.
It made me actually think a little bit of the Seal Pup situation. And that's that we're loving this minority group. We're loving them to death in some sense. It's becoming something else other than what it was.
But why is it loving them to death? I mean, Dan Savage was saying, bring on the straight people. I came to a Martin Luther King parade. I didn't go there to co-opt anything. I just thought, yeah, one more white face isn't a bad thing walking along.
It's not a bad thing. I don't think that's – I'm not trying to say it's a bad thing, but if it becomes something other than what it was, if it becomes something other than what it's intended for, if my interests as the straight white representative of government take over and predominate over the interests of the folks and the goals of the people who this parade is for and about, if my allyship becomes more important than the cause and the people that I'm an ally to, then I've overstepped. And I think the hard thing is to know when you've done that. And so what I've attempted to do just in my own life is I try to go into spaces where I'm not the majority, where I'm not the loudest voice, because it's easy. In a role like I have, people want to hear me talk a lot. So to go to community meetings where I sit and listen a lot and even can get criticized, sometimes quite loudly, and just take it, you know, and kind of hear it and think, all right, now what do I do with that, as opposed to reacting in the moment and debating it, or as opposed to instantly trying to do something, learn from the people who I want to help, what they need and what they want, and then follow that lead somewhat, as opposed to trying to tell people what I think they need and do that.
Any final words before I explain that seal pup reference to listeners who don't know what she was talking about? Yeah, that's going to pay off in a few minutes.
Yeah, one more thing about if it's gone corporate, then it means it's mainstream. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But if a corporation is going to go and they're going to bring thousands of people to march, at least put on a good float. I mean, just do something fun.
I think one thing we should always remember is that if you're going to be allying with a group and you're going to be joining in, your goal should never be to remake that group in your image or to have that group change to accommodate you. You already have space. You have plenty of space. If anything, the issue is that you are coming to one of the few spaces that marginalized people have. And so your goal should be to help preserve that space and provide whatever support is asked for in order to preserve and help that grow according to that community's stated needs. And so often, I think if you are not used to a space not being about you, your idea of equality is all spaces are about you. And that's not really how it works, because your first goal should be to make your space about the less privileged. And only until you've done that and that's successful can you then turn around and ask other people to adjust their space for you. And I think oftentimes what we see is people want to jump to the end. They say, you know, let's have change and let it start with you instead of let it start with me. And so people come in and they go, oh, this is a liberal space. And I'm going to prove how liberal it is because they're going to accept me as a white person in there and see this is how we can show that we are past race, instead of saying this is a white space and we're going to show how liberal it is by changing this space so that it fully, you know, accommodates the needs of people of color or people from the LGBT community. And you have to start with your privileged space first. And otherwise, you have no right to ask for any concessions from less privileged spaces.
Talking about what it means to be an ally with Ijeoma Oluo, Editor-at-Large for The Establishment, King County Council Member Claudia Balducci, Humanities Washington Program Director and Think and Drink plugger Zeki Hamid on The Week in Review. Sound Transit and Seal Pup still ahead. Here with KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. The Sound Transit 3 plan is ready for your ballots this November. Among our guests, as I said, we have Ijeoma Oluo, we have Zeki Hamid, we have Claudia Balducci, who's a King County Council member, and you sit on the board of Sound Transit.
Right.
Sound Transit's putting a $54 billion ballot measure to voters this November. And Claudia, the Seattle Times editorial board said that November's too soon. Voters need a clearer explanation of what they're paying for, and they need time to consider other options. What do you say to that?
Well, the ironic response that I immediately have to doing this too fast is that the first time that this region considered a full-scale transit system like this was 47 years ago. So to say we're doing this too quickly is a little ironic, but this planning process that resulted in this plan, this add-on to the Sound Transit 2 plan that the voters already approved and the Sound Move plan before that, we've been planning it for 3.5 years. We've had years of public meetings, thousands and tens of thousands of responses from people about what they think is important. We've had a tremendous outpouring of support from the community saying we need to have better transportation options that are accessible, that help people to get where they need to go. So I believe now is the time. This is what a light rail system looks like. And when you try to build it out, part of the proposal is we're doing a 25-year build the whole thing plan. Really interesting psychological observation I've had in this planning process is when you say to somebody, hey, here's the next piece. Your station isn't in there, but don't worry, you might get it later. They seem happier about that sometimes than yours is in here, but it's 25 years from now. That's actually harder to accept, you know, the certainty of having to wait for a while. What we did in the final package was we were able to speed things up some in recognition of that it was hard for people to want to wait. But I think what we would buy with an SD3 package is every 3 or so years from here until 2041, you would see new light rail systems open. You would see bus rapid transit come online. You will see all kinds of transit blossoming really into a full-scale system that people will recognize and use, and it will be very, very valuable to them. So I think now is the time. I don't think it gets any better. It certainly doesn't get any cheaper. If we had done this back in the 60s, the government, federal government, would have paid for 90% of it. Instead, they paid for 90% of Atlanta's MARTA system. And over time, the prices just rise. It just takes longer and costs more. So I really do think now is the time.
It may get more expensive, but as to whether it's a necessity, the Seattle Times editorial board said, among other things, closer to a necessity is fully funding public education, which, and we can't pay for everything. I mean, part of the state property tax would be taken up with the Sound Transit proposal. What do you say to that?
I really think that's a false dichotomy. I think we need to provide transportation and education. It's been demonstrated fairly amply, including in a recent Harvard study, that one of the most important things for a family or a person to pull themselves up economically and succeed is access to reliable transportation. We know that education is important for people to succeed. I think having to choose between two different things that people need to succeed is a false choice, and we shouldn't be asked to make that choice. In addition, the cost of this over time is less than the cost that we're all paying in our time sitting in traffic. People who have to move far away in order to be able to afford to buy a home or to have a home and drive all the way into town to work, and even those of us who are able to afford a nicer home and live closer in, we are paying every day in our time and not having a reliable opportunity to get to where we want to go, to be with our families, to get to work, to get to school. That is a cost. And it costs us more than the $54 million to build a transit system that will get us there reliably.
Okay, then let's talk more about who this benefits, because, Igioma, we do talk about public transit as being good for people who can't afford a car and gas insurance, maintenance, and the time of a long commute. But you're not convinced that this is helping the least advantaged? What do you think?
No, I mean, if you look at the property values along where this route is planned, it's some of the highest priced property values in each neighborhood that it runs through. So basically what we're doing is we're providing city access to rich people who don't want to drive or don't want to deal with our traffic. But our poorest neighborhoods are still too far away to even get to those light rail stations without a vehicle. But that being said, it has nothing to do with the timing. That's been the plan since the beginning. That's how it was laid out. And that's what we decided it was. So no, I'm not excited about it. I don't think it does much at all to help, you know, anyone around the Aurora corridor who needs better transportation, better bus services, better coordination through that whole system, less expensive public transportation that actually like works together and you don't have to do a billion transfers and pay more than you would in gas. But, you know, that was the design from the beginning.
I want to let Sound Transit's Claudia Balducci respond to the idea that this is not in the neighborhoods that need it most.
So one of the things that this package does, and in fact one of the criticisms that we've had for it, is that it goes fairly far out and it goes to a lot of different neighborhoods. And that's the light rail aspect. It goes to the south end of King County, which is where some of our most affordable housing is, some of our most impoverished communities are, is going to, after this is built, have really strong transit options. They're going to have heavy rail in the Sounder. They're going to have light rail with the light rail expansion, and they're going to have bus rapid transit. And all of this is in addition to the local transit system. King County has Metro. Pierce County has got Pierce, and there's community transit up in Everett and in Snohomish, which will help people to connect to those places and will be able to connect to them better because they won't have to serve the dense routes that are being covered by these other modes. So when the system grows, everybody gets better access to it. Everybody gets more reasonable, affordable, reliable. The transfer thing is real. If you have to make a number of different transfers, that reduces the reliability of your trip, and it makes it less comfortable to take. It makes it more, it's more nervous making. Am I going to get there on time? Am I going to make my connections? When we have every 10 minutes or so, your connection comes along, that's much less of an issue for the people who are relying on those transfer trips. I think the system as a whole will serve everybody better if we build it out. And then what's the alternative to not have transit, to continue to rely on ever-widening roads or ever-increasing congestion? I think that harms everybody as well.
Zaki, what do you make of all this?
Man, there are few things that rattle my cage more than arguments against basic infrastructure. I love transit. And I don't think this is some radical plan that connects every neighborhood with each other. That's what I'd like to see. But this is a pretty good start. Again, I would say it is a start. We need more and more and more. And we need to connect neighborhoods with each other. I like the plan. I'll definitely be voting for it. But I just don't buy the arguments of let's wait and see. Let's wait and see. Man, we have been waiting for a long, long time. And I want to know who's making money if this doesn't go through. So I always want to follow the money. So somebody's making money if this plan doesn't go through. And that's
somebody's making money either way, isn't it?
Well, at least I can get somewhere with this plan.
What about technology? Some people think that rail is a white elephant because we're going to technology our way out of this. We're going to have, well, self-driving cars took a little hit this week, by the way.
That's been a while.
Yeah, did you hear about the, I think he was Ohio guy, died while using the autopilot feature in his Tesla. Anyway, that technology's not there yet. But what this idea that it's a, this is inflexible, this is old technology, Claudia.
There's, even if we get there with more flexible technology, even if the safety is able to be resolved and we have, you know, this vision of technology in the future, I think it can do a lot of good. The hardest thing for a fixed route transit system to do is to get people from their house to the fixed route, because you cannot possibly afford to send it right by everybody's little neighborhood street. You have to have collector systems that bring people to it. And an autonomous vehicle fleet could do a really good job of that, just as Uber and Lyft and other sort of ride sharing can. But what they can't do is they can't change the laws of geometry. All of the people and businesses in downtown Seattle and the roads that you have in downtown Seattle or downtown Bellevue, for that matter, are only so there's so many people and there's only so much space. There was a fascinating picture on the internet this week. It was put up by a guy named Ben Schindelman from the Seattle subway, and it showed the space that it takes for a single occupancy vehicle car to handle 60 people, and the space it takes for an Uber or Lyft car to handle 60 people, and the space that it takes an autonomous vehicle, and they're all exactly the same, because you don't reduce the amount of space taken up when you have one person per car, regardless of how that car is being driven. Mass transit enables you to put a lot of people in one place at the same time and therefore get a lot more people through. And frankly, the way we live is increasingly in cities, and the way we work is increasingly in cities, you have got this mass demand, and that's what the trunk lines are for. The heavy light rail trunk line, heavy bus lines are for those trips to get people to work, and the other trips can be served by much more flexible means, but nothing beats high-capacity transit for serving those major peak hour trips.
We will continue to debate the merits, the pros and cons of the Sound Transit 3 plan, because you're going to vote on it in November. And finally, because we're just about out of time already, I can't believe it, but listeners are still wondering why Claudia said seal pup. So finally, when you are outside this weekend and you see a little harbor seal baby all alone on the beach, it looks sad and hungry. Maybe it's sick. Maybe it's orphaned. What do you do? Don't do what a woman in Westport, Washington did.
The woman saw a seal pup on the beach, got worried about it, thought that it was abandoned and was going to die, and picked it up in a shopping tote and took it home, then was not sure what to do and ended up calling the Westport Aquarium. They contacted the state Fish and Wildlife folks and went out there. They looked at the pup, unfortunately found that by that point the pup had become lethargic and unresponsive, and they made the determination that it needed to be euthanized.
That's fisheries official Michael Milstein telling you don't touch a marine mammal.
There's a natural human instinct when you see particularly a very young animal on the beach or somewhere like that and feel that it's in trouble, the instinct is to try to help it. But the challenge in this case is to realize that that really doesn't necessarily help it, and in many cases may actually hurt it in the long term by interfering in its ability to stay wild and to learn the tools and tricks of the trade that they need to make it out there in the long term.
The thing is, that pup might not have made it to the long term. It might have died soon anyway. Half the seals born in Washington don't make it to adulthood. So you show up at the beach, you see a pup alone, you call the Marine Mammal Stranding Network. We're tweeting out a link right now, at KOW, various phone numbers you can call. But maybe they're busy. They're not coming. Your kids are crying about the seal pup. You walk away?
Yes. Wildlife and me, I'm a city boy. I've always lived in big cities. Amman, Beirut, York.
You're terrified of the harbor seal pup.
Man, I would stay away. I don't know what that pup's going to do, or just stay away, let it be.
Sure, it's acting helpless, waiting for you to approach it.
It's devious.
Exactly. You never know, right? The seal pup has plans. I mean, the truth is we need to stop humanizing cute animals. All right, and I say cute because it is only the cute ones. If you want to save some wildlife, you know, reduce your carbon footprint. How about that? But don't go around trying to pick up animals and suddenly build this backstory that they're lonely and missing their mom. You don't know jack about that animal. Like, stop doing that. It's not okay.
Claudia?
I think this is kind of the opposite of the implicit bias we were talking about earlier. We're sort of hardwired to see something with big, sad eyes and want to help it. All our instincts kick in.
You want to be an ally.
We want to be an ally. We want to love the little seal pup. This is a matter of education, as far as I can tell. We just all need to learn the fact that human intervention with, you know, wildlife, especially, you know, apparently harmed wildlife, it may die anyway, but the outcomes are far worse when the humans get involved. There's a story like this every few weeks, it seems to me, that somebody picking up some wild animal, bringing it somewhere in the car, and it doesn't end well. So I think we just have to fight our instincts and call the powers that be, see if anybody can help it. But if not, understand that there's a downside to the wild. Animals die.
When I was 10 years old, I saw a kitten in the woods. And I picked it up. It scratched me all the way home. But I begged my mom. I named it Ringo because it had rings on its tails. And every night that cat slept on the back of my neck. I would sleep on my tummy and the cat would sleep on the back of my neck. And it was my buddy for years.
I thought you were going to say it turned out to be a raccoon.
It turned out it was a raccoon and it tore me to shreds. That's the surprising end of the story. Hey, thanks everybody for sorting through the week gone by.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Zeki Hamid, Program Director at Humanities Washington. Think and drink, too.
July 12th.
July 12th. Isn't that the next round?
Political incivility.
King County Council Member Claudia Balducci, you're against political incivility, I take it?
And in favor of transit.
Okay. It's Yo Maluo, local writer, editor-at-large for The Establishment. Always great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Live tweeting at KUOW, and thanks for tuning into The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke.